Welcome to Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 11, Episode 2. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
On this episode, we're talking about the future of global luxury retail with two guests that will be in Abu Dhabi at the Shop Talk Lux event January 27th, 29th that our friend Ben Miller is organizing. Amit Kaswani, Chief Omnichannel Officer for the Chalhoub Group, and Stacey Henderson Capece Matolo, Chief Marketing Officer, America at Todd's Group. Steve, not our first guest from the impressive Chalhoub Group, and I believe you may be the owner of several pairs of Todd's.
I'm not going to commit to several because they are a little pricey, but they're pretty wonderful. But yeah, I would say my favorite pair of shoes ever is a pair of Todd's loafers that I bought quite a long time ago now and have been trying to lovingly take care of them so I can enjoy them for even more time.
Slightly new format for the show with our take on the events of the week coming up first, as always, then a great interview, and then we'll be back with something that struck us as particularly remarkable for the week, and then a peek around the corner. So stick around after the interview. That's what's new. We'll be back after the interview with more great content coming up. All right, let's jump right in. News of the week, tariff turmoil. We see the judges saying, no, you got to give all that money back. And I guess Trump's going to appeal it to the Supreme Court. It's just more uncertainty, right?
Yeah, every time we seem to be getting closer to a little less uncertainty, something seems to happen. So this was the appeals court overruling not all of Trump's tariffs, but listeners may remember back in the spring when the tariffs were first announced, we had a conversation about how, to me, not as a trade lawyer, they obviously seem to be outside of the president's authority. The legislation is actually quite clear. There doesn't seem to be a ton of interpretation as to under what situations the president can implement tariffs versus what the Congress has to do. And really, the only exception is in the state of a national emergency, which, of course, Trump claims there is. I think 99.9% of the people that are not somehow mentally compromised would say, what is this emergency exactly? So it seems like a pretty straightforward case. It's taken a while to go through the court, went up to the appeals court, which then ruled that they are illegal. And as you said, this is now already being appealed to the Supreme Court. I'm pretty certain they will hear the case. What they will decide, obviously TBD. But yes, if it happens, something like, I think it's close to 70% of all the tariffs would be taken off, and presumably the administration would have to refund that money, which at this point is north of $200 billion. You could argue if you could delay bringing in some product because you might be getting a lower tariff rate, you would do that. But that's
I mean, we're talking Mother's easier said Day now, than done. Right? I mean, retailers are starting to think about bringing in Mother's Day. I mean, they're way, particularly apparel folks, they're way, way ahead into next year.
We're definitely ordering for many, many retailers. You're definitely into the period of placing orders for spring. You wouldn't typically be bringing in spring merchandise in October, but it's starting to bump up against spring planning for sure.
You know, the other thing that kicked in last week is this massive tariff against India. You saw it on, you know, not a political podcast, but geopolitically, you saw the meeting of the three,
right?
You know, the three big China, India, and Russia meeting and holding hands and sharing, you know, warm thoughts with each other. And
everybody loves a parade, of course. They put on a pretty nice parade.
But not leaving their DNA behind in any shape, way, or form. But North Korean wackiness. But what do we make of this India thing? I thought it was going to be a turnover, but there's a lot of categories of business that comes in from India. What are you hearing?
It's surprising. If you've listened to our episode with Ken Pilot over the summer, one of the, not to call Ken out on a bad prediction, because I thought it was a great prediction, he really thought that India was going to be one of the players that would, of the partnership with the U.S. and India would really be one where the most tariff favorite rates were quite low, with India being kind of a good alternative to China, really, and other places as well. And I would have absolutely thought that that would be the case. But now we're in a situation where India is at least currently being treated in the same kind of general vicinity as China. So it's quite interesting. It's wrapped up, I think, in a lot of egos. So I don't know where this is. I mean, it seems really hard for me to believe that it's going to stick at such a high rate. But the more that Modi is cozying up to Putin and Xi and continuing to ship oil to Russia and these kinds of things, who the heck knows? But that's another I think, surprising twist in this, which also adds a lot of uncertainty to the supply chain and just in general, where are some of these companies going to source this product? It's not, most of this stuff's not coming to the U.S.
Let's talk in Latin for a little bit. De minimis. So a big move. It's kind of one of those esoteric things that not everybody knew all that much about 2 years ago. I knew a lot about it because I've been on de minimis files for 10 years here in Canada. But boy, it's starting to shake through. We saw it in some talk about results, and now it's the end of an era. Talk about de minimis and then the red tape that it just takes to get things shipped into America now. The Europeans have stopped shipping. Talk about what's your impression of all this?
Yeah, there's a couple things going on here. So just for as a reminder to people, de minimis, the really kind of two major things is you get to avoid duties on products that are coming into the U.S. of value less than $800. It was raised to $800 years ago. It was $200. Mm-hmm. But also they're subject to less inspection and quality control. Originally, I think what Trump was trying to do was really go at China because a lot of Chinese product was coming in, Temu and Shein famously, but plenty of other Chinese products was coming in under this rule and avoiding tariffs. And also there were safety concerns, as I mentioned. So the Chinese thing already went into effect. And China's responsible for probably close to 60% of the products that come into the country under de minimis, or previously was as high as 60%. And then the rest of the change was supposed to go into effect in July of 2027. And for reasons that are unclear, really, other than he thinks that tariffs are going to solve some revenue gap, I guess, it was accelerated. And basically, people were given about 30 days to try to adjust. So the short-term impact has been, it's created a lot of pandemonium because the shippers, like DHL and others in Europe, were not prepared to deal with the paperwork and handle this. So as you mentioned, in some cases, some countries have just cut off postal shipments to the United States, which seems pretty crazy in this day and age.
Right. Shipments. I also heard, by the way, from some of those shippers that the rules and all the necessary things from America weren't in place for them to even understand or use. So it was not just, we don't understand it. It was like, there's not rules in place we can figure out.
Yeah, right? There's a tremendous amount of chaos. Mm-hmm. So that, we'll see how quickly that gets resolved. But I think we're absolutely looking at several weeks of reduction in shipments, even if people were willing to pay the extra. But from a business standpoint, if that gets sorted out, there's still quite a lot of impact potentially, or not potentially, I guess it remains to be seen how substantial it is, because there are lots of small businesses that are importing products from outside the country in these small quantities. They're not going to possibly be able to, it makes no sense for them to buy in the quantities that would allow them to avoid this. You've got Etsy, eBay, a lot of those creators, of course, sending $100, $200 type items. But you also have some major businesses. I thought that was really interesting and surprising, in fact, that Tapestry called out on their earnings call that 13 to 14% of all the products that they import come in under the de minimis level. Not quite sure why it's high, but they specifically called that out in their earnings, that having to pay these duties now, as well as just deal with the complexities we were just talking about, is going to be a bit of a hit to their earnings, in addition to other, you know, tariffs, things that have nothing to do with the $800 level. Yeah. And I think Lululemon also has talked about this. So it's not, I mean, mostly what gets talked about, I think, is the impact on the small businesses. Or, for example, if you have friends or family that live in Germany, they send you a Christmas gift, it's suddenly going to get a lot more expensive.
And take 2 months, because they're bound to be. I mean, the rationale of de minimis is, you know, grandma can send you a gift and we don't need to touch it. It was never meant to be used, though, by businesses in the way that it's been used.
Yes.
So I think that's fair. And in fact, I was talking to a retailer today that said, you know, this is going to create a tailwind for my stores. I have mall-based stores in America, and this shuts down a lot of stuff that was competing with me. And frankly, on an unlevel playing field, I got to pay tax on my stuff. So there's a bit of a tailwind for some retailers as well, you know. So it's a very complex but very interesting phenomena. You and I have talked about the impact of consumer confidence or low consumer confidence, and you've often said that there's not necessarily a correlation between low consumer confidence and spending in the retail sector, but we do see consumer confidence slipping. So do you think there'll be some longer term impacts from the news we're hearing this week?
Well, there's a few things going on. Maybe I'll tie this into what's going on in the job market. So yes, consumer confidence has moved down again. It's not that there's no correlation. There's just a relatively weak correlation or a lag. Consumer confidence had bounced back a bit post the Liberation Day, and now it's moving in the other direction. I think it is tied to both the fact that inflation is not moving down and appears to be ticking up a little bit. But there's also what's going on in the job market. And just this morning as we're recording this, the U.S. reported basically the weakest job market since COVID. Unemployment's actually, it did move up, but it's not moving up very much. And there's this kind of weird thing, well, maybe it's not weird, maybe it's to be expected, is that the labor supply in the U.S. is down. Now, a lot of this is a function of immigration basically being close to zero,
yep,
as well as people, quote unquote, self-deporting because of the fear of getting rounded up by ICE. But there's also less labor participation generally. I'm not quite sure what that's about. It could be because people aren't confident they can get a job, so they've stopped looking. So anyway, it's pretty clear that the job market is weakening meaningfully, but because of the supply being down, you're not necessarily going to see the unemployment number go up a lot. The other thing that happened this morning, which I think will be interesting to see what effect it has on the labor supply going forward, is as these ICE raids continue to go up, that's causing people to not go to the construction sites or whatever. But today there was the largest
Hyundai plans.
Well, yeah, that's the thing I was going to mention. The largest raid of a corporate facility ever was this morning. Something like 475 people were rounded up at this Hyundai plant. It's not been the case generally that immigration raids would take place in these large corporate facilities. And so that could have a chilling effect, which of course is what some people are trying to accomplish. But the impact on retail potentially or the economy more broadly is people not going to work. And I don't know that Hyundai is going to be able to turn around and find 475 people to fill those jobs quickly. Or if they can, they're probably going to have to raise the rates. So that's just starting to make this concern about labor rates being a driver of inflation going up a little bit more present.
Let's move on to earnings, and let's talk about what you're seeing. There's a batch of earnings, too many to go through, but any trends you're picking up?
Well, very quickly, this is a continuing trend, so I won't spend too much time on it, but I think I hate to say bifurcation, but I will. The bifurcation between results where we have quite a few retailers that for the most part have been doing well for the last couple of years, maybe longer, keep doing well. Abercrombie & Fitch, Ulta, On, Dick's Sporting Goods. I mean, a number of the players that we often talk about putting up pretty solid numbers. And then some of the other players that have struggled continuing to post poor numbers.
Interesting days. All right. Well, let's leave it there. Let's get to our fantastic interview on the future of luxury retail with Amit from Chalhoub Group and Stacy from Todd's.
Well, Stacy and Amit, welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast. We're delighted to have you. And I thought just before we jump in, maybe I could get each of you just to tell us a little bit about who you are, the work you do, and how you ended up in your current role. So perhaps, Stacy, we can let you kick things off.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much. I want to thank you and Michael for allowing me to be a part of this podcast. It's super exciting to talk about a lot of our passion points in retail, and especially for me, luxury retail. So my name is Stacy Henderson Capecce Minutolo. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer for the Americas for Todd's Group. So if you're unfamiliar with Todd's Group, or for those of you in your audience who are, Todd's has four brands. It's Todd's, Roger Vivier, Hogan, and Faye. And my responsibility as Chief Marketing Officer for the Americas includes marketing, e-commerce digital, CRM, client and customer experience, public relations, celebrity engagement, events and experience. So, you know, I was originally hired to oversee their e-com and digital business, but later my role expanded across, as you can see, multiple categories. Prior to Tots Group, I've held roles at other luxury goods companies such as Ferragamo and Versace. At Versace, I launched their e-commerce business in the U.S. some time ago and got the tech bug. I'm a marketer trapped in a tech person's body or vice versa. I don't know. That's still up for debate. But that was that's what I did at Versace, which was so exciting. Outside of my corporate life and what I do, let's say from 9 to 5, I'm committed to the future of the fashion industry and talent in the fashion industry. I've launched a non-for-profit called Fashion Tech Connects about 6 years ago. This non-for-profit places women of color in fashion positions. I'm also on the board of the Fashion Scholarship Fund and the board of the CFDA Black Advisory Group.
Excellent, excellent. And just for our listeners, as I shared before we get started, I am wearing my favorite pair of shoes, which are Todd loafers. So even though they can't be seen, I am embracing the spirit of the brand.
Thank you.
And Amit, how about you? What's your story? What is the Chaloupe Group about?
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. And I own a pair of Todds, as I mentioned before, and love the shoes. So a big fan. Thanks for having me. It's very interesting to really have this chat. So I joined Chaloupe Group about 2.5 years ago. Chaloupe is a family-owned organization, and we're celebrating the 70th anniversary this year. It's really a unique organization in the sense that we operate multiple brands in the GCC predominantly. We have some smaller businesses in Latin America, in France, and in India. But really, the group is built on luxury brands, and we operate both distribution, franchise. We also do JVs, and we're very focused on our own retail brands across really beauty, fashion, and homeware. I've been in a very similar industry for the last 15 years, which is there's maybe about 30 to 40 large organizations globally which are family run and operate multiple brands. So I spent about 12 and a half years prior to moving to Dubai 2.5 years ago, working for two very similar organizations, not the size of Chaloupe, probably half the size, operating essentially everything which is digital and commerce. My current mandate is Chief Omnichannel and AI Officer. I run 4 distinctive verticals. The first one is what we call customer. So anything customer analytics, CRM, performance marketing, marketing attribution is one vertical. The second one is loyalty. We operate 2 loyalty programs. One is a program which has close to 3 million customers, and another one is a VIP program. The third one is product technology. And last but not least, part of my new mandate is the group AI strategy. My background is predominantly marketing and sales, and I moved into more of a digital transformation role about 16, 17 years ago.
It's super interesting that AI is part of your title. We'll get to that a little bit later in the podcast. I want to explore, unpack that a little bit. Let's talk about the industry with both such accomplished leaders in the industry. It's fair to say that it's a dynamic. Fair to say it's also been a bit of disruption in recent years in luxury and the fashion business. But a lot of that depends on which geographies you operate in and what your particular marketing or market position is. Amit, with the diversity of your brand portfolio and your strong positions in growing markets like the UAE and Saudi, what trends are you seeing and how is your organization responding?
From a market perspective, GCC has shown to be a bit more resilient despite the global slowdown. Most of the categories we're operating in are still growing at single digits. And we really predict the next 3 years to have kind of anywhere between 3 to 6% growth. So we're really driving the organization to support that growth. This market is unique in that the UAE continues to grow both from a population, people moving over here, and tourists. We continue to beat records on tourism every year. And we've got Saudi Arabia, which is unique in terms of the growth of the middle class, right? The realities we're really focusing, it sounds like a buzzword, but it isn't. So we're really focusing on customer experience, omni-channel, with heavy investment in all our channels, which are retail, e-commerce, clienteling, and really customer care. The one thing which is now different to 5 years ago, the GCC customer is well-traveled. They expect excellence in customer experience. They've been to Paris, to London, to the U.S., so we're really committed to that customer experience, which is all about, effortless connected experiences.
Stacey, what does that look like for Todd's across the America, and what makes Todd's special? How are you experiencing an American, North American consumer that is starting to perhaps appreciate the luxury market even more so than before?
Yeah, so, you know, in the United States, as we know, or as we may not know, the personal luxury goods market is approximately $80 billion, depending on your source, correct? And I think sort of what Emmett just mentioned, it's we are really looking at, you know, our clients, especially focused on the high net worth and the ultra high net worth individuals. Mm-hmm. So the high net worth individuals in the United States, there's approximately 6 to 8 million of them. These individuals have approximately $1 million more in investable assets, not including their primary residence, right? Okay. So that's the focus. But you also have your ultra net high worth individuals that have over $30 million in net worth, right? Mm. And so for us, you know, being that the U.S. is, you know, the number one luxury goods market, and that this the amount of people with this kind of wealth is so huge, it's obviously important to look at not only them holistically, but also in various markets, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know that New York is number one for both these individuals, followed usually by L.A., Chicago, et cetera. So that's one thing I think overall about the U.S. market that we take into mind. The second thing I think is this very interesting dynamic with these high net worth individuals, and also what I call the influential generations, which are the millennials and the Gen Zs, and how they are influencing the trends and what's cool, even though they may not have the money to actually purchase something at the moment.
That's interesting. They're
highly influential at their parents or the baby boomers or whatever, which I think is also something super important to keep in mind when you look at the U.S. market and its dynamics.
And I guess we could talk about the influence of social media that is so now pervasive across all customer segments, whether you're segmenting by age or segmenting by the value of the customer. Yeah,
no, absolutely. Definitely.
Could I just ask you a follow on question on that, Stacey? So, and this is something that we dealt with very much at Neiman Marcus, where you have, you know, potentially a huge percentage of your customer base coming, generally speaking, from older, very affluent or wealthy, as you point out, customers. But if you're trying to attract that younger customer who, let's say on average, is considerably less affluent, does that really affect your merchandising strategies? Or is it more, in other words, you know, say some brands have done, you know, getting into the fragrance or sunglass business to be able to give kind of that opening price point. I don't know if that's really the right term for a high-end brand, but, you know, that lower price offering to get people into the brand on the hope that maybe a decade later they'll be able to spend $1,000 for a pair of shoes or whatever the item might be.
Well, you know, I think for us, I can point out something recently that it was more of a communication piece, less of a merchandising piece. So we know that, as you guys both mentioned, our Gomino is our iconic item, right? We recently did something, a campaign, Italian Diaries, where it was not by accident that our Milan team created this beautiful content. It was less about an entry price point item, but it was our Gomino, and the focus was on really like the up and coming, let's say the younger generation. We worked with Ella Blue Travolta. We worked with Stella Banderas. And that campaign in itself, actually, the fact that we were speaking to that generation and using like this beautiful story that kept the brand's DNA with an iconic product, but having, let's say, this fresher generation, this younger generation, like sort of talk to it and show how they're using it. And the campaign was very successful for us.
Maybe we could turn our attention a little bit to, well, you know, there's so many different dynamics going on in the luxury and the fashion market, obviously at the consumer level, but there's also a lot of shifting going on in go-to-market strategies, distribution strategies, the blend of physical and digital. Amit, I know this is very much part of your remit. As you think about how the industry has been evolving and how Shalhoub, across its various pieces of its business, has been evolving its go-to-market strategy, what perspectives would you have on this?
You know, we're constantly bringing on brands as a multi-brand organization. You know, we're always out on the hunt for new franchise distribution across all categories. You know, so we're now in the last 3 years. I think the entire leadership has changed over the last two and a half years with new leaders coming in. We've got a new COO. We've got a new CFO. I've come on board. So really bringing a new mindset to how we operate the business. The key focus for us, which is kind of the fundamentals in terms of go-to-market strategies. One, we want to be purely omni-channel from day one. This is full infrastructure channels to serve the customer. So we're looking at the end-to-end experience. And you know, if a brand comes to us and says, we want to open a retail store to test the waters, our response is, no, if we're going to go in, we're going to go in with an omni-channel strategy and the entire planning has to be done end to end. The second piece of how we operate as an organization, and given the size of the organization, one of the things Patrick, who's our chairman now and was CEO until this year, his commitment to the organization was we were going to own the end-to-end experience. That means that we typically don't outsource any of our services. If you think about customer care, if you look at e-com delivery, if you look at a lot of the services that we offer as an organization, that's one of the strengths and that's what we do. One of the things that is really important to us is, you know, we run customer care for 12 hours. We own our own fleet for e-com and we're able to do deliveries in under 2 hours in most of the major metros for e-com auto. So that's incredible for us from a service perspective. Yeah. And the third thing is we've been investing heavily in our loyalty program. You just touched with Stacey about different categories, right? We go from an average order value of $150 when we talk about beauty to over $1,000 when we think about Level Shoes, which is one of our flagship stores. It's the largest shoe store in the world in Dubai Mall, and we'll be opening in Miami in 2027, 2028. So the loyalty program for us is it's a great tool in terms of customer engagement, customer acquisition. We're launching credit cards next year, both in the UAE and Saudi Arabia. So I'd say those are really the three pillars we focus on. When we engage with brands, when we negotiate with them, we bring these things to the table in terms of our capabilities and go-to-market strategy. Last but not least is access to real estate. One of the reasons people partner with us is because we're a 70-year-old company, we have some incredible assets already in the ecosystem. We hold great relationships with mall owners. So that underpins a little bit of how we operate and go to market.
Stacey, you know, Amit's talking about and he's touched on engagement and loyalty. So I wanted to kind of follow up on that. And you've got an expansive remit. It's so interesting having the two of you on the same episode because of the different ways that you both have very expansive remits. How do you think about the customer needs and involving the different strategies? I mean, you know, every customer, all of our customers, all retail customers have so much going on around them. And how do you kind of get that, you know, from table stakes to differentiators in terms of driving engagement and loyalty for your brands?
Yeah, I think the first thing is just the overall mindset. And for me, when I think especially about luxury and luxury consumers, I think the first thing is that we have to move away from this mindset of purely transactional, but relationship. Right? I think that, you know, when you look at your different customers, and especially when you're dealing with the high net worth customers, these ultra high net worth customers, you know, I always ask myself, and when we talk as a team and have these team meetings, what are we going to do to romance these customers? What are we going to do to make sure that we are forming a relationship with these customers where then they become a part of our community, right? And where they, and we know their needs, we sort of anticipate these experiences. And I'll give a couple of things. We've paid so much attention to this, especially the past few years. When we have our top customers, you know, and we look at the different markets in the U.S., we have 7 stores. We look at our different customers and we'll say, okay, what are some of these for our top customers? How are we able to make sure that when we put our plan together for the year, what are we able to offer them? These money cannot buy experiences. These things, not just for the sake Great of point. A transaction, mm-hmm. but for them to then move, for them to move closer to the brand, mm-hmm. for them to feel closer to the DNA of Tots, and I didn't go into detail with this, but as we know, Tots, the brand, you guys mentioned Ergomino's, is focused on the Italian lifestyle. It is focused on, you know, craftsmanship and this artisanal intelligence. And it's just focused on, not last but not least, it's a very familiar kind of brand. We're focused on people and we're focused on family, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we move our customers closer to that, that it goes beyond the product, of course, and it goes beyond a transaction? Yeah. And we do that in many ways. We do that by, you know, with our top clients, it's really about those super high touch points of, we call them client treatments. And it could be anything to inviting them to our fashion shows and doing programming around that when they're in Milan, because there they can really get the full immersion of the brand and what the brand stands for. It could also be things such as things that we do in the US or globally that we invite our clients to. Or it could be things where we look at different moments in their lives, moments that matter, their anniversary, their birthdays. We're able now to get that specific with clients and be there, not in a weird, creepy kind of way, but in a way that feels natural, because, you know, we get to know them. And again, it's less about a transaction and it's more about this relationship and romancing them the way you would if you had a great friend or, you know, someone that you really felt close bond to.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, because it's not, though I'm sure you one of your objectives is more shoes in the household. It's not exactly a frequent purchase, a frequency play, right? It's that relationship play that you're talking about. It's so interesting.
It's fundamental.
Well, see, Michael, you gotta pick the customers that want to buy shoes frequently. That's part of the art, I think. But Amit, just maybe pulling on that thread for you, you know, it's interesting to me, and I'm probably no surprise to anybody who's listened to the podcast for a long time, having worked in this multi-channel world for more than two decades, and very much of the belief that you really have to start from that omni-channel perspective to begin with. But I guess when you're talking about some of the things that Stacey was just alluding to and really wanting to have that more relationship-driven view, does that pose any challenges in terms of the way people tend to use digital channels that could be a bit more transactional? So I guess, how do you think that more about that more holistically?
So listen, some data, an omni-channel customer spends about 50% more than a single channel customer for us. So we know from a data perspective, and close to 23% of our customers now are omni-channel, which means they bought in both channels. It certainly poses a challenge, but the way we're looking more and more at e-commerce is two things. One, it's a great customer acquisition tool. So one is, how do we effectively acquire customers, especially through the e-com channels, through a lot of performance marketing? And once we're able to acquire that customer, how are we able to communicate, especially to her, to bring her through our retail channels and retail experiences? A lot of what we've done in many of our own concepts, for example, Level, which is, again, top biggest shoe store in the world, Tanagra, which has beautiful homeware brands like Christoffel, which we own, Baccarat, Lalit, etc., is really about acquiring these customers, then offering them the experience to be in store. And a lot of what Stacey talked about was really with those VIP customers, creating moments. We've been able to take customers to our factory of Christoffel in France. And a lot of what we do in loyalty is driven by experiences. So I talked about Muse, which is a program with 3 million customers. But as you go up the tier, it's not only the points, it's about the experiences we can offer you, and we invest behind those. Think about, you know, anything around products like an expensive handbag. How can we help you, you know, make sure that we can clean that bag, make sure that that product, and this is a service adjacent to shopping. And we have another program called Elite, which is our top 1,000 customers that typically spend over $100,000 a year, and really building out a VIP community with clienteling services. And we go beyond just the transactional pieces. The team really thinks about booking restaurants, booking travel. So it's the extension of the purchase, which Stacey was talking about, and how do we capture moments, and how can we be with them longer, just over and above the shopping experience.
I love this discussion around personalized, remarkable experiences. And I wonder if we could adjust the lens, so to speak, and pop the hood, get under the hood about technology for a little bit. And Amit, since it's right in your title, I'm going to start with you. You've got AI in your title, which in and of itself makes a pretty interesting statement. I've seen other retailers. A friend of mine just has a title now of AI implementation. So it's clearly we're moving into a different phase of AI. Talk about technology and the role of technology in delivering those experiences that you're describing.
I mean, listen, from a technology, we're investing heavily, right? We've gone are the days of having monolithic tech stacks. We're really thinking about two things. One is what is headless, what is composable, and what's the right sort of tech stack that we need specifically around CX. And it all comes down around customer experience. So one side is what we're investing in really through, and it's not new, you know, composable headless has been around for a while, but we're really saying, what do we need to be agile enough for the over 100 brands we have? The second thing is AI is interesting, and you asked me how it came into my title. As an executive committee, we looked at a 10-year plan, and one of the capabilities that we decided we needed was AI. And it's not only AI. We say AI, but it's AI, data, and technology, because all three are really linked to each other. So what we said, if we want to reach our 10-year objective, we have to be really strong when it comes to our AI capabilities. So we went out and, you know, naturally, since my role is a lot around transformation, the natural choice was for me to take this on. So we've hired a team, a set of consultants. And if we think about the three key areas we're investing behind, and there's many areas we're investing behind, but I'm going to focus on three key areas really around customer experience. First one is, which every retailer is doing, is really focus on customer care. What are the chatbots, automations, which both from a customer and our teams are going to help us provide better customer experience? So we're thinking about chatbots, and not only for customers, for our teams, what is the next best action to resolve any questions, problems? The second one is we're investing heavily in building our own predictive models on first-party data. There's enough AI tools out there to help us drive recommendations, but that's not proprietary. So we've made a key decision that when it comes to predictive models, and it's on not only first-party customer data, we do things around sales forecasting, warehouse capacity management, store capacity management. So that's a big piece, which is more on predictive AI. And third is, listen, the future of commerce is changing very quickly. We are of the opinion that conversational commerce is going to take over from the standard click, add to cart, checkout. So some of the things we're investing in, we've already deployed some specific chatbots for our beauty business, is really about conversational aspects around what is the routine, what is your skin type, and being able to provide those recommendations through a chat. We've rolled out a POC and the results are quite incredible. We're seeing average order values of close to 20 to 25%, which tells us that we're on the right track. So with the predictive models and the chatbots, and testing out this whole future conversational commerce, I think those are the three key areas we're going to be investing in.
A quick follow-up. What's your level, the organization's level, of either excitement or concern around the evolution around AI agents? Like, you know, in other words, the consumer's use of AI to shop you and your brand. Stacey, I might ask you the same question just broadly. But Amit, how are you thinking about the consumer's use of AI over and above how you're thinking of the organization is using it?
So two parts to it. One is when we talk about AI agents in our automation and day-to-day tasks, that's certainly things we're already experimenting with. What's absolutely clear is there's going to be a transformation on how work is done, because repetitive tasks are going to be replaced. When we talk about that, there's a focus on one, how do we deploy those agents? And it's not for us about optimizing headcount. It's making sure that as we deploy these agents, how do we upskill our internal resources to do different types of roles? So that's one thing. The second thing, when it comes to customers, I think the more FMCG brands are going to come to a situation where you're going to have agents talking to agents. I think in the brands where we are, where Stacey is, where we are, it's going to be a bit different. I think agents will be there, but there's still a different sort of discovery versus, you know, if I want to go buy a toothpaste, it's very transactional. I'm going to get my agent, tell him what my preferences are. They're going to go buy it from whichever online store and have it delivered. I think with our brands, there's still a upper funnel discovery piece, which will be driven a lot more through conversation than anything else.
All right. And Stacey, no need to unpack the marketing stack for your organization, but technology, very important, no doubt, for you as well. What's your perspective in getting that, using that technology to engage and increase loyalty?
Well, I think that, and this, I'm just going to take a step back because I don't think, I know I didn't discuss this during this podcast, but I think the one thing is just to remember that when we're thinking about technology overall, and especially in the luxury goods where you think about offline and online, I think the most important thing is to stop thinking about them separately, right? And to remember that, especially in the luxury goods world, it's very, when you're dealing with that level of client, it's the orchestration, in my opinion, that creates the magic, the orchestration of what you're doing, how you're using technology to drive people in store and vice versa. I've seen this firsthand in how, you know, when I first started at Taz, how in a few years, you know, we tripled our e-commerce business, right? What we saw with that it was basically an extension of our physical stores. It was not a replacement of it, right? So I say these things, so I just want to sort of go back and highlight the orchestration of both online and offline. I know the technology always plays a role into that. I also sort of want to go back and sort of touch on something about these physical experiences and what that means for technology and driving people, you know, drive that brand amplification. Like I mentioned, when we think about technology and we think about the digital world, for me, it's a way of amplifying your message to a number of people that you could never reach in your physical stores. You're talking to tens of thousands of more people that come to your site versus, you know, the hundreds of people that obviously come into your door or so a day at your physical stores. So, you know, I say that because when you're thinking about your strategy, I think about in technology, it always has to start with the consumer, and it always has to, in my opinion, not be binary and think of either or. And Taz, we've seen that play over and over again. And I'll just give a quick example. We had a seasonal store in the Hamptons for a few years. And of course, you have your store, you have your, you know, your launch for your store, what you're going to do for that season, right, to drive people to that physical store. But we knew that, again, the clients, our clients, were there, these very high net worth individuals were at the Hamptons at this time. And so we knew from a brand point of view, it's great to amplify our message. How do we do that then to create the desire about the brand? So in addition to the tactics that we did in our store, the physical piece of it, the physical things that we did were these physical experiences. And every year we always had one, which was, quote unquote, the event of the summer in the Hamptons. And the way we were able to express this and how this played into like the digital world and technology was we had our physical experience and event. For us, it's important always, again, to go back to who we are as a brand, Italian, artisanal intelligence, et cetera. So we flew an artisan in from our factory in Italy. They came to this beautiful event that we did in the Hamptons, overlooking the water. It felt like you were in an Italian villa. On top of that, we really were focusing on, of course, our key products, the Gomino and the dye bag. So we had the artisan literally stitching a Gomino by hand the way we do in all of our factories. From that, though, we know that as part of marketers and part of business people, you have to always inject something that's going to be culturally relevant for that digital amplification. So being a kid from the 90s, and at the time it was hip hop's 50th year anniversary, I decided to have an iconic hip hop group perform at this event, right? And the reason I was trying to, like, the goal was to, you know, fuse in this iconic, these iconic products with something that was culturally relevant, the U.S. icons. So we got Salt and Pepper to perform
fantastic.
At this event. You guys, when you talk about this fusion between offline and online, 2 billion impressions from this event, 2 billion impressions from one single event. So this is how we use this physical moment to then for our digital amplification. And of course, the content, I think every single person, it was a very intimate event, only 80, 90 people, A-list celebs, the who's who in the Hamptons, these high net worth individuals, every single person posted on social media multiple times. It was incredible. What does that mean? And I say this because I think my philosophy overall with these tools and technology is it goes back to your brand's DNA. It goes back to what you want to accomplish. And it they should be things that work together in unison to continuously communicate, this is what the brand stands for. And I think that's super important. When we get specific with AI, and I can tell you, for me, my philosophy is that AI is a thought partner, and this is what I'm using it for. I can give you some specific things that we've been testing at TOS that I think is quite interesting. In the past, you know, when we have our customer service team that I oversee, and if a person spends X amount, we'll reach out and say, hey, you know, thank you for your purchase, for spending X amount with TOS Group, et cetera, the next day. We have live people doing this via text or via email. And then afterwards, there is a flow where you come back and you might want to say, you know, you might want to like say, okay, well, I hope you enjoyed your pair of Gominos. Check out these products X, Y, and Z that you might, you know, that might complement your Gominos. Believe it or not, a lot of that was manual, right? It was manual with our customer service team. But now using tools that are just there, we just recently did a test where we put in the data. We started very small with our top X amount of clients. We did not put their names in, but we put in like, this is what our top clients were buying. Can you please help us recommend future products for them to buy in the future, right? And when, how should that cadence occur? And when our customer service team did this, one, of course, was a lot more efficient, right? Because they're not manually looking back and forth on our website or calling the stores. But not only that, they saw a lift, which I think was quite remarkable. And what I found that was so encouraging about this, it really wasn't about, okay, we got to use this, we have to do this. But we know this is something that we're already doing. But the question is, how can AI help me do this better and faster and to get results that are a little higher than what we had in the past?
Stacey, you know, everyone is really focused on understanding AI, both from the internal process and how consumers are using it. How do you, as an organization, approach it? Do you have an AI czar? Do you have a organizing committee with governance, or you leave it up to each, you know, you in marketing, your counterpart in finance or whatever? How do you guys approach that?
Yeah. So some time ago, TOTS actually established a global AI task force that I'm fortunate enough to be a part of. This task force is led by our chief digital officer, Alessandra Demizi. And it's multidisciplinary. It has people that are sitting on there from customer service, merchandising, marketing, e-com, and finance. Mm-hmm. And the whole point of this is how to look at AI from a strategic lens and make sure that we're looking at it not just siloed, but instead as an organization strategically. It's something that the company started off strategically. And for TOS, it was very important, of course, under the direction of Alessandra, to make sure that it is something that we look at holistically across various departments.
Interesting. Now, who chairs it? Is it a CTO role? Does that even, like, who sets the agenda and kind of, eventually these committees have to make decisions and sometimes there needs to be a tiebreaker. What role does that?
Well, the person who chairs this up is over our digital innovation office. Her name is Alessandra Demizi, and she is the chief digital officer for the group.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, it's so interesting, and obviously a lot more we could really dive into, but we are coming up against our time, so I just wanted to maybe get to a couple things really quickly. One is we were connected by the Shop Talk folks who are debuting a new conference, Shop Talk Lux, in Abu Dhabi in January, and I believe both of you are going to be speaking there, but it's a few months off, so perhaps you haven't quite worked out what you're looking to do at the conference and what you might be speaking about. But to the extent you have any initial ideas, Amit, what are you hoping to learn and or hoping to share at Shop Talk Lux?
No, looking forward. It's really exciting that they're doing it in our region. So that's fantastic. I think two things, really understanding we talked about technology, we talked about customer experience, so really understanding, and it's been great, you know, to be on the podcast and listen to Stacey, just to share what's happening in different markets and what we adopt. And I already know what I'll be presenting, and it's really, we've developed a framework which we call Think Omni, and it's our internal framework, more of a call to action with five pillars, which is all about leadership enablement, assortment and pricing strategy, customer journey, omni marketing, and front of house empowerment. We launched it this year, and it's really how we're building our capabilities. So I'm going to be spending time talking about this during my presentation.
And how about you, Stacey?
Yeah, I'm excited about a few things. One, I'm excited about really like some super clear case studies about AI, how it's improving people's businesses, how it's helping them grow, very tactical ways on how people and companies are using this in the fashion industry and the results they've seen by using various tools. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, I cannot wait to hear and talk about the loyalty with clients, again, getting away from the transaction and romancing the clients. And the last thing is, I am very excited to have a discussion about the high net worth individuals and how you, of course, cater to them and you focus on them because you know they have the money, but also balancing that long term with the future generations, the millennials and the Gen Zs, as I spoke about.
Stacey, I'll invite you over to our VIP lounge in the Dubai Mall when you're here. Let's connect. Wow. I think it'd be a great experience.
Oh, fantastic. You know, I've never been to the Middle East, so I'm super excited.
Super.
Fantastic. Well, listen, this has been a fantastic discussion. And I wanted to end with, you know, it's been really a whole session, a masterclass in many ways from the two of you around advice for our industry fellow retailers. But do you have any extra advice or any following up advice that that you could share, that, you know, what you think the industry and your counterparts should be focusing on in the next year? Amit, why don't you start and then Stacey?
I think it's what we focused on, right? Everything begins and ends with customers. Tech channels discovery evolve fast, but we must be anchored in customer experience and expectations. And my advice is focus relentlessly on customer experience. That should be the guiding star for everything we do in an ever-changing retail landscape.
Stacey?
I cannot agree more. It's focusing on the client and experiences. I also think for the luxury goods market, I will have to say there's also one thing I would encourage all my peers to also think about is, you know, yes, you know, you can look to the right or the left at some of your peers in luxury fashion, but don't be afraid to also look out of the industry for some of those best cases or best practices that are outside of the industry as well. And, you know, I think that what we have to sometimes move away from is the copy and paste and looking at only what other luxury brands are doing. But instead, you know, you have to look and see what's culturally relevant. You have to look at other industries and you have to almost sort of stop trying to check the box and really do things that are going to impact your business.
Well, what a fantastic way to wrap up a great conversation. As I said, a masterclass from both of you. Thank you both so much for joining us on the Remarkable Retail Podcast. Steve and I really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights. And we wish you both, on behalf of Steve, wish you both continued success, safe travels as you manage your business, and success for the rest of the year and for 2026. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
We wanted to now get to our new segment. Last episode, we called it This Goes to 11, which pretty much no one gets. But so we've rebranded it or branded it what it was originally, which was...
Cracker Barrel. We like stuck with the new branding for one episode.
We rolled that back. What was particularly remarkable in the news this week? You go first.
Well, this isn't really a hardcore retail story, but we've talked about the GLP-1 type drugs and how impactful they can be really broadly with people losing all sorts of weight that could drive, well, I think is driving, replacing your, you know, if you lose 30, 40, 50 pounds, you need all new clothing, right? But it also affects CPG companies and other things outside of traditional retail or the restaurant business, portion size, all that kind of stuff. But even though lots of people, I think in the US, something like 11% of the population has been on a GLP-1 type drug in the past year, part of the issue is price, and part of the issue is people don't like needles, or many people don't like needles. So there is a GLP-1 drug on the horizon that's made it through the first level of clearance. So I think that's pretty exciting.
In a pill form.
I'm sorry, maybe I skipped over that. Yeah, no, a pill rather than injectable. So I think that could be a real unlock for the next level of volume. I don't think we know much about the pricing, so it may not be dramatically less expensive. But I think in terms of people's squeamishness about injecting themselves, that could really expand the possibility for individuals, and then, of course, the ripple effects throughout the economy.
What I've been looking at is Nano Banana. Have you heard of this? I've
heard of it. Yeah, that's the Gemini version from Google.
That's right. It's the Gemini image manipulation. I actually sent you a couple just before the show of you and I on the stage from Commerce Next. I don't know if you looked at them, but I did four or five versions, one of which you're on my shoulders and we're dancing. And it's hard hard to see that's not a real picture. A retailer brought this up to me today literally and said they're very excited. They've already started using it. You know, let's see this model in different hair color. Let's see it in 30 different hair colors. Let's see in 30 different fits. It's image manipulation that is pretty seamless. And this one retailer, very excited about it. And this is a retailer who's very on trend and you know, has seen both useless things that have a lot of buzz and very useful things. So Nano Banana. All right, we're going to finish up with this other segment, another segment called On the Radar, kind of a peek around the corner, what we're thinking about for the next couple of weeks.
I got a few things. I mean, obviously, we talk pretty much every episode, it seems, about kind of macroeconomic stuff, tariffs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. anyway, we've got the Federal Reserve meeting and making an interest rate decision, and a lot of interest, of course, no pun intended, in what happens there, whether they will take interest rates down 25 basis points, 50 basis points, whether they may not do it. What that all signals is that because they're worried about the economy slowing down, is it because it's overdue and inflation's really not a concern? So there's lots of commentary, I think, over the next 10 days or whatever will be before that decision. The other thing that's definitely on the horizon coming up really, really quickly is, and we seem like in the U.S. we're here every few months, is the possibility of a government shutdown. And that could, if that happens, of course, could cause a fair amount of chaos. Not that we need any more chaos in this country right now. And related to that, just in general, the possibilities of escalation of more things. We talked about the ICE raids. Is they're increasing? The Trump administration is way behind the numbers of where they wanted to be. I also think they're very happy to distract from the jobs numbers and Epstein and all that kind of stuff. So I think that just may lead to more kind of wag the dog, just to use another old reference that most people won't get. And military going to Chicago, military potentially going to other cities. So there's a lot of protest activity that's really escalating and being planned.
So it's shopping and going out for dinner. I mean, you were in Washington and we were commenting. It's like, it doesn't feel like a great place to go out to dinner when you're looking at somebody with automatic.
No, I think restaurant reservations, I don't know if they still are. I haven't seen a recent number, but I think restaurant reservations when that started were down 30 or 40%. So yeah, it can be significant. Another thing I'm looking at, and we've of course touched on this multiple times, it's related to the broader luxury story, which is what's going on at Saks Global. I actually had an opportunity because I was down in Houston and Austin last weekend to get into a few of the Saks and Neiman Marcus stores. So there's a Neiman Marcus store in Austin in the Domain. I thought it looked really good. I didn't sense that there were any issues with inventory. Of course, that's been one of the topics we've touched on a bunch of times, that vendors aren't shipping. That was not evident, or they were hiding it very well. One of the real unique, or not terribly unique, but one thing that you can only see, at least in the state of Texas, is a Neiman Marcus and Saks store in the same mall, the Houston Galleria, which is a humongous mall, like ridiculously large. I think by square footage, it's one of the top five malls in the country. And both stores were busy. Both stores looked pretty good. The Neiman Marcus store looks pretty dated. The Saks store felt much more contemporary and current and a real buzz. but I didn't, again, see, now these are big volume stores, probably, I don't know, in terms of where it ranks in the Saks, I'm guessing a top five Saks store. I'm pretty sure it's a top five Neiman Marcus store. So there's a lot of volume there. So if they're distorting inventory, that would be the place to distort it to. So, but really the question is, they're very short on cash. There still are complaints about vendors not getting paid. And just in general, the cash pressures.
For me, I'm looking forward to going to the grand opening of Les Maisons Simon, which is a department store in CF Eaton Centre, which is Canada's most trafficked mall. About 50 million people go through that mall, and they're taking the place of Nordstrom that was there. And it's the grand opening. I've seen some early renderings of it looks like a beautiful store. They've done some wonderful architecture. So I'm looking forward to seeing that. That's two stores in the Toronto area that they've taken over, one in Yorkdale, one in Eaton Centre, both of which have taken over from vastly underperforming Nordstrom stores. So we wish Simons, folks at Simons, Bernard LeBlanc, very well. And that's what I'm looking at. All right, well, let's leave it there. Great episode. We'll be back next week. We've just got a roster of fantastic guests coming up. We've been working super, super hard to line up the most interesting people in retail.
Thanks for tuning in. To help more retail leaders discover the industry's leading podcast, please drop us that 5-star rating and review on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you enjoy your pods. And for more on my strategic advisory services, keynote speaking, best-selling books, and even more retail industry insights, go to stephenpdennis.com.
If you are a brand or service provider looking to take your influence to the next level, reach out to us for sponsorship, advertising, or event partnerships. And if you want to learn more about my own keynote speaking and advisory practice, reach out to me via LinkedIn.